From diplomacy to design thinking as an approach to intervention in Syria, are there networks of people and communities of interest that could create the capacity for peace and governance closer to where people live and far from where diplomats negotiate? Alexa Courtney is the executive vice president of Caris Associates, a strategy and design firm that focuses on conflict zones, including Syria. Listen now to the mind of a designer with the heart and dedication of a great humanitarian.
A challenge like Syria, where you have many overlapping dynamics and it's hard to sort out what's actually driving the conflict, what are the sets of grievances, you have many, many actors, all of whom have their own agenda, it's hard to know where to start. The U.S. government couldn't go in and interview and try to really understand from a human perspective what was happening on the ground, bottom up. That was really an opportunity for us to say, we think we can bridge a really important gap. So we worked with Syrians on the ground and developed multiple different networks and then worked with different government clients who had some really pressing issues and questions, I might even say blind spots, and connected the two.
From the perspective of someone who's observed the United Nations and a lot of these conflicts, I think most people have the impression that, well, all you do is put a blue helmet on, say that you're the United Nations, you walk in and then everybody talks to you.
Yeah. For many years, I worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and I did exactly that. So I would go in with a team of other Westerners trying to understand what the drivers of conflict were in places like Afghanistan, Nepal, Bangladesh. And, you know, we had pretty sophisticated research protocols, and we would ask questions, and we thought we were getting good answers. It turns out you really have a profound observer bias when you're doing that. And the more sensitive the question in Syria, for example, who's funding you to do what, it takes a long time to build up that rapport. And in very conflict-affected environments, there's very low trust. So you just can't parachute in from the outside and ask those very sensitive questions.
One of the issues that came up in the John Kerry hearings after the chemical weapons controversy that came up in the fall was how many of the opposition are jihadists whose only interest really is establishing a base and getting a bunch of weapons and eventually turning their guns against Western sources. There were lots of percentages thrown around. There were senses of most of them are jihadists. Very few of them are local. How do you resolve something like that?
Despite some of the numbers thrown around, you know, we've been able to say that there's roughly between 3,000 to 10,000 members of a group like ISIS or al-Nusra, both of whom are al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria. Small relative to some of the numbers discussed in that Kerry briefing. What's really difficult is to sort out the ambitions and the objectives of a variety of opposition groups, some of whom are armed and clearly have transnational terrorism objectives like ISIS. Others are really just focused on kind of protecting their turf and trying to win the allegiance of their population. So in the city of Aleppo, we're running a different project where we're working with networks on the ground that on a weekly basis are updating in real time on a geospatial platform called Caris Geo how checkpoints are moving around the city and who manages that checkpoint. And the reason we care about checkpoints is because that is a proxy indicator for territorial control. And so then you can look neighborhood by neighborhood in Aleppo and see which ones are under regime control this week. Have they shifted? If they're under opposition control, who's managing those checkpoints? You get a very clear sense of the actors and their patterns of influence in a town.
Now, who's uploading that information to the geomap? Is it local spies? Is it just citizens?
Citizens whom we've trained. We pulled them out to Gaziantep in Turkey and trained them on the platform and the research protocols. Then they went back. They're all Aleppo residents, and they kind of reflect a broad demographic. Some are citizen journalists, students, doctors. It's really a range. And so on a weekly basis, they're uploading directly there. And then we're doing the data analysis back here.
And so when policymakers come to you and say, who's controlling this neighborhood of Aleppo, you have a precise and correct answer.
That's updated weekly.
That's hugely valuable, it seems.
It's incredible. And it really just shows the power of the ability to plug into real-time decision-making by building trust on the ground. Another just quick example, we were asked by the government last fall, what do we do about the bread and fuel shortage in, I think this was also in Aleppo, last November, December timeframe. And you didn't really see any reporting about this shortage yet in the New York Times, but our government clients were asking us about it. And within 4 hours, our staff were Skyping FSA commanders, Free Syrian Army commanders, who controlled many of the supply routes into and out of a particular neighborhood in Aleppo, and were able to actually understand what was driving the bread and the fuel crisis, which was not at all a shortage. It was very intentional campaign of influence by the regime. They had bought up all the surpluses. They were denying it into a lot of the rebel-controlled areas, and then people were lining up long lines, and that was creating a lot of tension and nervousness, and that was very intentional. The trick here, and again, just to underscore the point, is to take key patterns in the environment that we're able to validate on the ground with confidence and plug that into U.S. government policy decisions and planning processes, right? And I think that's really important to be able to be that bridge, because otherwise there's a proliferation of assumptions and major blind spots. And I think bringing it back to design for a moment, really seeking first to understand from the community's perspective all of the very complicated dynamics has to be your starting point. Or you make policy blindly, you push through programs that aren't going to have meet the objectives you want, or worse, have really negative impacts. So I think this is a really, really important role we're playing.
Based on what you see, do you think the U.S. should be more involved in the outcome in Syria, in controlling the outcome in Syria?
That's a tough one for me as a former U.S. official. Yes, I would have liked to have seen us do something much bolder early on, you know, years ago. I think now it is really difficult to sort out what to do, and we don't really have the domestic political capital to support something that I think would be bold. It's an incredible shame to see the chronic suffering and the devastation, and it's pretty clear to me that it could undo the region.
Does the Foreign Service and military planners need more designers to create credible policies as this century moves forward?
Fundamentally, because I don't think policymaking is about deciding between two options. As Roger Martin said, you know, people who invoke the power of analytical thinking will choose between two options. People who have grown up in the world of design are very expert at creating options for a future state. So designing for a revolution or mitigating a revolution is hugely important. It's a fundamentally different toolkit.
A design challenge.
Indeed.
Alexa Courtney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexa Courtney is Executive Vice President of Caris Associates. It's a strategy and design firm that focuses on conflict zones.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.